Okay, welcome to our latest edition of Paincast by the Pain Science Division. I'm Lisa Carlesso, your host for today. Today we're going to be speaking about complex regional pain syndrome. I'm happy to be bringing this topic to you because actually in the member survey that we did recently, it was actually one of the most requested topics for a Paincast. So I'm glad to provide this topic to our membership. Luckily, we have two experts right here in our own country to speak to this, Janet Hawley in Ottawa and Michael Sangster in Nova Scotia and Halifax. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
And I'll just throw the mic over to each of you just to introduce yourselves and give a little bit of background about your expertise in this area. So if you want to just maybe go ahead there, Janet.
Okay, as Lisa said, I work at the Ottawa Hospital Rehabilitation Center, and I came to the field of CRPS due to the fact that patients started showing up on my doorstep, and what I learned in school way back in 1990 wasn't really working. So I was starting in my master's at that point, and I decided to make this the subject of my master's major work. To sort of get down to the bottom of it as to alternate treatments for CRPS and investigating some of the things I was seeing with my patients. So, a little bit about myself. I'm a clinical specialist with the Canadian Physiotherapy Association. As I said, I have a master's from McMaster, and I sit on the International Association for the Study of Pain Special Interest Group Subgroup Task Force on CRPS to come out with clinical and research outcome measures for this population.
Excellent, excellent. So lots of expertise there. Mike, how about yourself?
Well, Janet's a hard act to follow. I work at the IWK Health Center in Halifax. I'm a graduate of Dalhousie University. I too am a clinical specialist in pain science through the CPA. Interesting, when I was listening to Janet's story, rather, what I learned in school also wasn't working as I came to treat patients with CRPS. I work on the complex pediatric pain team here at the IWK, and we see a number of patients with a diagnosis of CRPS or what we call CRPS-like diagnoses. And what I learned in school was failing miserably. So that led me to a relentless hunt for a better answer. And in doing so, I think we're getting less wrong as we approach our management of CRPS. And certainly that's been my pursuit over the last decade or so.
Excellent. Well, that's certainly encouraging to hear that we're getting less wrong. That's always a good direction to be moving in.
Nope, we're quite right, but we're less wrong. That's for
Yes. Okay. Well, I thought we'd start out just by actually talking about what CRPS is, and specifically talking about where it falls. Is it more orthopedic? Is it more neuro? And what your thoughts on that are. So, again, Janet, how about you start with that?
Okay. Well, way back in school, I learned that it was a problem in the localized tissues. We now know from the research that it really is more of a neurologic problem, where we have autonomic changes, vasomotor changes, and sensory changes in the brain and the spinal cord, as well as some of the localized tissue, which I think Mike wants to talk about. So I'll segue to him.
So, I think the bigger question is it a peripheral or a central condition? And in preparation for this talk, I thought I'm going to dig out my textbook from school, which is an old one. So I blew the dust off of it in the basement, and I looked up what was then termed reflex sympathetic dystrophy. Now we talk about this complex regional pain syndrome. And the definition was, and I quote, "a generalized hypovascularity to a part caused by increased sympathetic activity resulting in atrophy of bone, nails, muscle, and skin. In short, all musculoskeletal components." So it was interesting for me because it was defined as a peripheral condition, and I think we as physiotherapists come from a long line of peripheralists, and it's difficult to think of it as anything else sometimes. And what we're seeing now is that actually the answer is that it can be both a peripheral and a central condition, but we see centrally mediated changes, brain changes in the structure of the cortex that may be involved in perpetuating pain, certainly are correlated with pain intensity. And it leads us to the idea that perhaps management needs to address the central issues in addition to the peripheral manifestations of the condition. And unfortunately, there's a lot of treatment out there that remains that still focuses on it as a very much a peripheral condition. You know, if the hand is involved, it is the hand we must treat, as opposed to looking at it from a more comprehensive evidence-based perspective.
Yeah. So it sounds like maybe there's some knowledge translation efforts that need to be made there in terms of increasing the awareness of the fact that it is more central.
Definitely. And we do know now, too, that some of those peripheral versus central changes are actually along a timeline, and that we will see more peripheral changes versus central within the first 3 months. But after 3 months, we're dealing with predominantly central changes at that point.
And just out of curiosity, how long has it been, kind of roughly looking back in time, I guess, when did this change come about in regarding it as more of a centrally mediated condition?
There is a paper that I think sort of draws a clear distinction, and it's the author is Mayhoffner, and it is 2003 or 2004, I can't remember, I think 2004, okay. And it looks at, does functional MRI of a patient with an upper extremity, what they defined as an acute CRPS, and it really maps out the somatosensory homunculus of the patient and shows significant cortical change on the affected side. So, you know, if we're talking 2004, it's a decade at least that there's been sort of this compelling evidence. And I think it's probably prior to that, but that actually had the images, which really, you know, on seeing that can help but change the way you view this condition.
Yeah. Well, I know a little bit later you're going to have more to say about brain changes in MRI, Mike, too, so we'll wait to hear that. But I wanted to just move on to discuss what some of the risk factors and then by extension kind of talk a bit about prognosis for CRPS. And so, Janet, I'll give that one back to you again.
Okay, so risk factors for CRPS. We do know in the Colles fracture population, any patient that's complaining about pain of greater than 5 out of 10 for over 2 days, this is considered a significant red flag for CRPS, and you should be assessing for it and potentially managing it as such. We know from research done by several different people in the literature that when we're looking for a personality type or other comorbid psychological factors that one would think might lend somebody to be at high risk for CRPS, the literature actually doesn't support this. There is no psychological profile that makes one at greater risk for developing CRPS. At ISP this year, though, they did present some research that looked that in some families, there seems to be a genetic linkage, mm-hmm. But that doesn't hold true in all our patients. But in some patients, you certainly can see familial histories going back several generations of what appears to be CRPS in all the generations. So they're looking for a genetic allele at the moment. And then we do know, and it's well recorded in the UK guidelines that were published in 2013, that prognostically, if you don't identify and manage psychosocial yellow flags, your patients won't do as well. So the yellow flags they listed was negative family influences, inappropriate beliefs despite education. Very passive treatment sessions, lack of willingness to set goals, patients who suffer anxiety and depression, distress, people who are very dependent on their splints or their cast boots, litigation, like most of our chronic pain patients, poor coping strategies, and iatrogenic factors, which actually comes back to health professionals, how they talk about the condition, how they explain it, and how they explain prognosis.
And I think I'll pick up there and just say to agree with you, Janet, on the psychological profile. There was a recent study that came out of Boston Children's Harvard University that that looked at the presence of psychological profile in patients experiencing, that is adolescents experiencing, persistent pain, and there's no greater percentage of individuals experiencing persistent pain relative to the general population. So when people, and often in my world, people will talk about CRPS as being a condition that's associated with the anxious child or something like that, and come forward with a psychological basis for the condition. And I say, well, yes, I treat kids that have psychological issues, but they're no more prevalent than your kids. You know, it's of no greater percentage in this population than in the general population. So it's an interesting note because it's often associated, I think, perhaps due to lack of understanding, clinicians associate this with some sort of psychological or psychiatric issue, and it's simply not true.
One of my biggest sort of things I have to explain to everybody is they often say that these patients have fear of movement. And I think fear of movement in this population sometimes is a very adaptive strategy to being able to get through the rest of the day. Because for some of the severe CRPS patients, any movement at all may mean a night of no sleep or several nights of no sleep. So they're actually trying to cope and manage in their world by not moving the limbs. So you need to find another way to get there rather than just say, move your arm.
I think that's it's a great point that you've both made about the lack of kind of psychological profile, because it is something that is quite prevalent in other conditions, right? Like chronic low back pain, even osteoarthritis. We're seeing these associations coming out more and more. So I think that's a really great point for clinicians to be aware of, and as you were kind of, you know, inferring there, Mike, to not kind of make the assumption and that it is due to that condition, that it's you know, this is kind of common across whatever all children or all adults that we see here like this. So,
and I would suggest in my adolescent population that the vast majority, I'll stop short of saying 100%, but the vast majority of patients I see with CRPS or CRPS-like features have been at one point in time or another been told by a healthcare provider that it is something that is in their head.
Right. Psychiatric.
Yeah, and Janet, you made a good point there about the language that we use as practitioners and how we identify that and how damaging that can be. So lots of good little tidbits for people to be aware of. Let's move on to diagnosis. I understand that there's some criteria out there that are used. Can you tell us a bit about those, Janet?
Yes. So through the years, different things have been used, but the international standard that's been agreed on by the International Association of Study of Pain, special interest group in CRPS, is the Budapest clinical diagnostic criteria. They also have a research diagnostic criteria, but I think we'll stick with the clinical one tonight. And it is basically something that can be done anywhere, anytime. It doesn't involve special tests. It is a clinical diagnostic group, and it's, I'll break it down. You need to have continuing pain, which is disproportionate to any inciting event. The patient must report, and this is the patient reports, one symptom in three of four categories. The first category is sensory, reports of hyperesthesia or allodynia. The second category is vasomotor. So this is your temperature asymmetries, your skin color changes, your skin color asymmetries. The pseudomotor, edema, sweating changes, sweating asymmetries. The fourth one is motor trophic, reports of decreased range of motion, motor dysfunction, be it weakness, tremor, or dystonia, or trophic changes of the hair, nail, or skin. The third part of the diagnostic criteria is, this is where the clinician must be able to see one sign at the time of the evaluation in two or more of the four categories. So sensory, there must be evidence of hyperalgesia to pinprick, allodynia to light touch or deep somatic pressure, and or joint movement. Vasomotor, there should be evidence of temperature asymmetry, and it's always best to actually measure this just in case your hands aren't of the proper temperature, and or skin color changes and or symmetry. And pseudomotor edema, evidence of edema and or sweating changes and sweating asymmetry, and motor trophic, which is evidence of decreased range of motion, motor dysfunction, weakness, tremor, dystonia, or trophic changes of the hair, nail, and skin. Often my adult women, when they have trophic changes of the nails, like to wear nail polish. So you might not be able to see their nails. And then the last condition is there can't be any other diagnosis that better explains the signs and symptoms, which means you can't just go, oh, it's CRPS. You actually have to think of possible other diagnoses that need to be ruled out. And that's pretty much the standard used everywhere now in clinics that treat patients with CRPS.
All right. Well, that was quite a list. So that's good. I'm glad this is being recorded so that people can go back and and listen to it.
If they Google Budapest criteria for CRPS, it'll come up in a GIF.
Excellent. Okay, and Michael, you've been talking about kind of CRPS like presentations that you see, and also the fact that you're dealing in a more pediatric adolescent population. So, how is diagnosis look through your eyes?
So we also use the Budapest criteria. It's interesting and perhaps a pediatric phenomenon. I see a lot of patients who will come to me with on the referral, it'll be a questionable diagnosis of CRPS, or quite often I see questionable RSD, which is obviously the old term. But I may see in using the Budapest criteria that they don't quite meet the Budapest criteria for a clear diagnosis of CRPS, but there certainly are features that indicate that there have been central changes, so brain-related changes. So we may see things like hyperalgesia and allodynia, but we may not see some of the other features. And the management really is largely the same. And we categorize those folks as CRPS-like. That's the term we use in our clinic amongst the clinicians, because it does sort of feels like CRPS, but doesn't quite meet those criteria. So I think our population is a bit, or the treatable population is a bit expanded beyond the Budapest criteria, as opposed to what we may see in adults. I rarely see the presentation like the picture that we all had in our textbooks of what RSD is supposed to look like. So it's very rare in pediatrics to see it that way. I do see it, but I see far more patients that meet some but not all of the criteria.
Unfortunately, because I work with a tertiary care center, I do see some of those patients who have fallen through the system and haven't gotten proper care early on. I would like to add two things. One is the differentiation between CRPS1 and CRPS2. CRPS1 means that you have no nerve injury as part of an injury prior to the development of CRPS or at the time of the development of CRPS. And CRPS2 is in the presence of a nerve injury, like a peripheral nerve injury, a brachial plexus, sacral plexus injury. And then the other thing that people need to be aware of is there is such a thing as the development of insidious onset CRPS, where a particular trauma actually cannot be identified.
And I think, Janet, it's important that when we talk about that a particular trauma might not be able to be identified because we don't have the diagnostic equipment sophisticated enough to identify it. Microtrauma around the neural tissues, for example, is not something we're going to see on MRI. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, and I often come back to that. So I see a lot of gymnasts or figure skaters, dancers, people who have perhaps a significant hypermobility and have no appreciable mechanism of injury yet present with a CRPS-like presentation. And if those people are sitting somewhere on a connective tissue disorder spectrum, then it's quite conceivable that they have a micro injury, if you will, that we're not, you know, that we have to just speculate on, but that we're not going to be able to find because we don't have diagnostic tools sophisticated enough to determine that.
And there is evidence, as you know, in the literature of people who've developed it after insect bites and IVs, yeah, things that we don't normally think could cause something as traumatic as what CRPS turns into.
All right. Well, that's this is just great. You guys are such a wealth of information. It's fantastic. So I do want to move on to treatment, because I know that is probably the thing that clinicians are most interested in hearing is how do we treat it. But before we do, I just want to, I guess, ask Mike just to touch on if there's anything in the content that we've covered so far. Is there anything that you want to add in terms of differences between adults and peds or...
Yeah, certainly. Thank you, Lisa. I was wanting to chat a little bit about brain related changes. So we have talked about that earlier on in the talk. There is one paper in 2008. The author is Lebel, LEBEL, for anybody who's interested in the journal's Brain, and it looked at a dozen patients or so. And looked at functional MRI to evaluate the changes in their central nervous system, changes in their brain, patients with lower extremity CRPS. And what they found was there were significant changes in the central nervous system circuitry, similar to that of adults. However, in adults, sometimes we will see that those changes are reversible. But in this very small sample size population, they found that the changes in the central nervous system, the changes in the brain, outlasted the signs and symptoms of CRPS. So after the CRPS had resolved, the brain changes remained, which we may not see in adults. We may see a reversal of the brain changes with symptom resolution. So the question then becomes, you know, what is the effect of this cortical change that persists, the apparent permanency of it, at a time of developmental plasticity, and does that impact pain processing or predispose patients to greater pain later in life? So what's interesting about the study is that the patients were between 9 and 22 months duration post diagnosis of CRPS. So we don't have any data on patients with managed at an earlier time point, but it does beg the question that given that there seems to be potential for permanency in brain change, does it mean that it's that much more important to get to the pediatric patient with CRPS faster in order to try to take advantage of the potential for changing or reversing the cortical changes? We don't know whether that happens or not, but certainly it seems like perhaps earlier diagnosis is more important.
Yeah. And Janet, you mentioned that you saw, I think you said it was the first study out about looking at genes
yes.
in this. And so, you know, just as I'm listening to you, Mike, I'm just thinking that hopefully we'll see the literature obviously develop around the genetic, and now sounds like we need to look at the epigenetic influences and kind of, you know, following that from adolescence through to adulthood and what the implications are there. So hopefully lots of good research to come.
Lots of stuff is going on out there.
Good. Okay, so let's get to treatment. And I know, so both of you you're going to talk about some specific things and also within the context of Janet, you treating adults, and Mike, you a younger population. So let's we'll start with you, Janet, and okay, how you approach your adult cases.
Okay, so I'm going to frame everything sort of into what I would call the four pillars of treatment, and then talk specifically about physio. But the big four pillars of treatment is the physical and vocational rehab, the psychosocial interventions that are going to be necessary, the pain relief from a pharmaceutical or procedural in severe cases, and patient information and education to promote self-management of CRPS, because it really isn't a cure to CRPS, it's a management process. So if we look at physio's role there, it really is under the education and the physical rehabilitation aspect. And what I start off with is really graded motor imagery. And I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with graded motor imagery because of Lorimer Mosley's work and some of the courses he's taught around the world, where you really have to get the patient to be able to do laterality recognition, so the ability to know the difference between a left and right hand on a card, a left and right foot on a card. And the idea is that we're really trying to impact S1 and S2, the actual homuncular area of the brain that represents that limb. The research study that Lorimer did to show that graded motor imagery works said that you had to do 2 weeks of laterality recognition, followed by 2 weeks of imagined movements, followed by 2 weeks of mirror therapy. And I don't know if it was the acuity of the patients he may have had in his study group, but where I work, 2 weeks just doesn't cut the mustard. It takes a lot longer before you can progress somebody into imagined movements. However, part of his research protocol was that the patient had to do the components every hour. And the real world of most of our patients is they can't participate in physiotherapy every hour for 10, 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. So to get the same results, it's going to take a lot longer. So once you've finished with the laterality recognition, then I will ask a patient to imagine using that limb. I like to start from a pleasurable activity to really impact the amygdala in a positive way, because we do know there are linkages from the amygdala to S1 and S2 and CRPS, that it isn't functioning the same as it does in a non-CRPS population from the bold images. So I like to set the stage with, think about something that you really enjoy doing that involves that limb, and something that's not too complex to start with, and then moving towards more complex movements. And then we move in when that's going well, and they're able to do that for a period of time, 5-10 minutes at a time without having any symptoms an hour later. We move into mirror therapy, and mirror therapy really is starting with just looking at the unaffected limb in the mirror so that you're seeing what would be the affected limb, but you have to remove all signs of recognition, so watches, rings, etc. And starting with no movement, changing the position of the hand, because often I find if a patient only looks at the back of their hand, you may think they're doing really well, and then you flip their hand upside down, all of a sudden they flare, because really it was the underside of the hand that they have greater problem with. Mm-hmm. So making sure that they're starting with no movement in all the different positions of the hand, and then moving to movement, and then moving to bilateral movement. And for some of our patients that seem to be more sensory affected than motor affected, but have severe pain, we're doing sensory work with the mirror as well, where we will start by touching the unaffected hand. And so they see you touching their unaffected hand in the mirror, and then touching both hands in the mirror. But we'll start maybe not at the place of the most acuity of the pain. So if it's an arm, I might start at their shoulders before I do their hand, because the hand, being the most distal part of the limb, usually is the area that's most affected. And then I will add from that things like sensory integration. So I call it bean therapy. Go to your local bulk barn and buy a whole bunch of different shaped dried beans, because any patient can afford that. And really we're looking for the ability to discriminate what it feels like from left and right hands. So really trying to build those sensory networks. And what we're looking for is either, once again, can't be worse after an hour, but what we find sometimes is there's some beans that take away pain, and then others are just neutral or creepy but don't flare symptoms. And I should probably stop, because as Lisa pointed out before this pain cast, my treatment protocol is pretty long, but that's pretty the standard one, I think. And 2-point sensory integration. So Lorimer Mosley really promotes now, based on his last research, that you have to do 2-point discrimination. So having a patient have 2 points of contact on their limb, and they have to say, do they feel one or do they feel two? And he really promotes that those two contact points have to be two different objects. So I might use a wine cork and a pen, and they have to tell me which one's the wine cork and which one's the pen.
And do they have to be a certain distance apart? Or?
Yeah, well, you have to start with where they can identify to and then moving inward. Okay. So for some patients, that could be 10 centimeters.
Right.
So it really depends on the severity of the CRPS. And I'm going to stop and let Mike talk.
No, and you know, I agree with you, Janet. We take a very similar approach here. I wanted to comment because you mentioned Lorimer's original study, and I think this is a very important point for people to understand, is that Lorimer used a statistical term that we often don't see in physiotherapy, and that is number needed to treat in that study. And the number needed to treat is the number of patients you'd need to provide an intervention to, often a drug, because it's what pharmaceutical companies use, in order for one patient to have a 50% reduction in their symptoms. So in that original study by Lorimer Moseley, the number needed to treat for a 50% reduction in pain using graded motor imagery that was maintained at 6 months was 3. So that means we'd have to give the intervention to 3 people in order for one to get that 50% benefit. Now, immediately, those listening, and when I say this to groups of physios, the shoulders sort of sag, and people say, well, that's not very good. And I say, well, if this were a pharmaceutical company,
that'd be awesome.
The marketing executives would be doing cartwheels up the hallway now because they'd have a very marketable drug. And if we were to compare some of the anticonvulsants or opioids or antidepressants or something else that someone might want to try in the management of CRPS, they would find that graded motor imagery is a far more effective solution using that number needed to treat as a statistical term. So I think it's important for physiotherapists to know that, hey, we have something here that is better than most pharmaceuticals on the market for the management of CRPS.
Yep, and that's...
That's quite something. Anyway, sorry, Janet, go ahead.
No, I was going to say the number needed to treat for gabapentin, they actually shared at ISP this year, and it's 1 in 8.
Yeah, so what we have with no side effects or no appreciable side effects relative to medications is far more effective. So it's that's an interesting point. What I wanted to do in talking about management is really say, I'll quote the late Patrick Wall. Patrick Wall says that pain is a need state, much like hunger and thirst. If you're hungry, what do? You eat. If you're thirsty, what do? You drink. So hunger and thirst are need states. They require you to do something in order to extinguish those sensations. They require a consummatory act, consuming food or water or something to drink. And he says pain is exactly the same, and the consummatory act is movement. So when we're in pain, we need to move. Now, the challenge is, and as you mentioned at the beginning, Janet, is that movement sometimes in these patients will cause them to have a flare for 2 days. So the pain in this sense in CRPS is really a defensive response. The brain has decided that for whatever reason that part of the body is not healing. It sets the sensitivity of the nervous system at a level that causes a significant pain response. So then the question is, how do we introduce movement? How do we give that patient the opportunity to move under the radar of a pain flare? And graded motor imagery gives us that opportunity. It is movement without moving. It allows us to access the parts of the brain responsible for movement and feeling in a way that doesn't activate the limb and generally cause a pain flare. So it gives the patient that opportunity for movement, which I think is the wonderful thing about graded motor imagery. So I use it as you've described it. We also do sensory work and sensory discrimination, or what we may call tactile acuity training, using different objects like a wine cork and a pen tip, because that's what we used in the study that you're quoting. And I think it's important here to note that we've got a handful of papers that talk about that. And this is an example of where in physiotherapy we are really leading the charge and building the plane while flying it in the management of CRPS. We a handful of studies does not the truth make, but this is benign enough that we need to move forward with it as a potential option for our patients. And the last thing I wanted to talk about with that was time, because I always look back to that original study by Lorimer Mosley and think, oh, how could I get my, you know, I work with the least compliant group in the history of the world.
You know? So, I don't know about that. Adults are pretty bad too.
We'll have to argue over that one. But you know, if I'm working with teenagers, you know, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to comply. So how long, how much do we do? And typically I start out with, and this is a Mike Sangsterism, I start out with 30 minutes. And it seems doable for patients, and 30 minutes a day, that is. And they often will increase their dose of movement. And that's how we talk about it. They'll increase their dose when they start to see that, hey, you know what, this is making a bit of a difference to me. This is changing the way I'm experiencing my pain, or it's reducing my pain, allowing me to move more freely. And then they'll ask me, can I do more of this? And I'll say, yeah, up your dose. That's what you need to do. And they'll add time when they start to see success with it.
Mm-hmm. And Mike, I assume that when you're saying 30 minutes, and based on the irritability of these people, that you're talking about that time being scattered across the day.
Yeah, and so with greater motor imagery, often I don't see a flare-up from what it is that they're doing. It seems to be quite tolerable. For me, it's more about their intention than it is about a flare-up. So with an adolescent, for example, if we're doing mirror therapy, while we're doing a session in clinic, I will be looking at their gaze to make sure that they're still engaged in the mirror therapy task, because they have to be looking in the mirror in order for them to be doing anything. And if I start to lose their gaze, I know I've lost their attention, and that will sort of set the treatment time, if you will. And if, for example, they're able to attend to the task for 5 minutes, well, they would have 6 5-minute sessions throughout the day. That's how we would break that up, because it's very important that we keep them engaged throughout the process.
Great. Did you have something to add there, Janet?
Yeah, one of the problems I really struggle with is the busy family lives and busy life work balance, with people still trying to stay at work with CRPS, really struggling and trying to fit the exercise in with it. And tolerances, it's not uncommon when I start graded motor imagery that somebody can tolerate looking at 2 or 3 cards of a hand, and that's it. If we go to a 4th card, they're going to flare past the hour. So when I have somebody that low, it really is important that I can get multiple sessions in a day, because if they only do it 4 or 5 times a day, they're not going to get changed. You just don't have enough repetition to change neuroplasticity. If we think of Laura Boyd's work in stroke patients, you need 2,000 repetitions to change the neuroplasticity for a movement. That's a lot of repetitions. Mm-hmm. So trying to get adults to work this into their day, I often will even work it into WSIB plans and write it in the plans so that it's almost mandated by WSIB that they have to do this stuff at work, just to make it happen.
I think the other key bit here that we've sort of touched on but not gone into detail on is the setup, the patient education. Mm-hmm. So it would be a colossal failure for me to provide a graded motor imagery program to an adolescent who doesn't understand the nature of their condition, the nature of CRPS. So foundational to my approach is providing pain neurophysiology education. And we get down into the weeds with it. We really talk about what's happening from a neurophysiological perspective, you know, the level that the patient understand. And often I see the adolescents that I see are very hungry for the information, and they often will say things to me like, well, you're the first person that's treated me like a human being in this, because you're actually talking to me about my condition. And if we don't have if we don't develop in them a clear understanding of the nature of their pain experience, then anything that we ask them to do, you know, could be counterintuitive. If we're asking them to do movement at some point, you know, their understanding is that movement hurts, so I won't do it. So we need to make sure that we've laid the groundwork prior to, I think, embarking upon any movement strategy, graded motor imagery or otherwise.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
I would agree with that as well. And a lot of clinics and hospitals have explained pain classes that are already in establishment for all their pain patients. But with CRPS, that education really has to be specific to the diagnosis, to slip them into that class and expect them to understand their condition because of the autonomic changes, the immune changes that are specific to this condition. You can't really do that. You really have to do one-to-one with them. And then you have to repeat and repeat because every time they get into a flare, anybody with anxiety or prone to anxiety tends to forget the basic education that you've given, and you have to be ready to go again and do round two.
I agree with you completely, Janet, and I said this just the other day. I was chatting with our team, and I have the luxury in the public system of taking the time with my patients because we're not telling them a pain story. We are telling them their pain story. Mm-hmm. And that is very important. And it's important that we relate it back to the story they've told us so that they integrate it as part of their story. It's not a general pain story. It has to be theirs. Mm-hmm. And only then, I think, do we have the opportunity, the foundation set to build upon. And I agree with you. Boosters are key. So I provide boosters, pain boosters, all the time. And sometimes that's a statement or two, and sometimes that's sitting down and actually reviewing the principles of pain neurophysiology education again. It really depends on the needs of the patient when the patient needs it.
Yep. All right. Well, I'm just cognizant of the time here, and just want to move towards wrapping up. And I just want to get from both of you perhaps just, some kind of overarching messages for clinicians. And maybe a thought on, what to do, if you can, briefly, what to do with the really hard cases and people that aren't responding with treatments, and just so that they know kind of what are some other resources that are out there and that they can access. Janet?
Okay, well, my overarching statement that I tell my patients and tell any clinician looking for help is, in the end, it really doesn't matter what you do as long as your patient's symptoms, and I mean all symptoms, not just pain, color, temperature, swelling, you name it, an hour later are no worse. And if you keep to that, sometimes you can get away with quite a bit, surprisingly with some patients. But the patient has to be reflective, and you need to give them the time that they're supposed to be checking in with their body to make sure that what you're doing is okay. But what do I do with my tough patients that don't respond to greater motor imagery? I play a bit with virtual reality because it's very much a sensory proprioceptive environment. It is a place you have to go into cautiously. Patients tolerate usually 2-3 minutes at a time with virtual reality and no more. For people that don't have a great VR lab, I also do some low-tech sensory work with wobble boards, high-density foam, balance rocks, bath mats, front entry mats, all kinds of different tactile surfaces for the feet. I have different things for the hands as well. And really getting back to those base principles that if a baby learns their sensory system by interacting with the world, can we change the neuroplasticity by providing sensory inputs to rebuild that homunculus from scratch? It sometimes works, it sometimes doesn't.
Yeah. Those are great suggestions, though. Okay, Mike, over to you for the last little bit there.
So the first thing I would say is when someone walks through your door with complex pain that may be CRPS or CRPS-like, believe them. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, believe them. And secondly, I would say teach everyone. Make sure that you are providing a very solid foundation. Respect the fact that that person needs to hear about the nature of their symptoms and that they're capable of hearing it. They're capable of understanding it. We have some research to suggest that patients, yes, are indeed capable of understanding the nature of what they are experiencing if we just take the time to provide them that foundational knowledge. And that is very, very helpful. And I think for the patients that are really struggling with a GMI approach or another approach, it really is critical to seek out a multi-D environment, multidisciplinary environment, so that they have access to the supports, the pillars that Janet mentioned at the start, primarily the ones that we don't provide as much of, those being psychosocial support or pharmacological pain relief. Because really, although we do have I think one of the best tools in graded motor imagery. Nothing is really ever in isolation. We need to work as members of an interprofessional team. And if we have the psychological strategies, the pharmacological strategies, the physical strategies working in tandem, we have the best opportunity to help these patients, I believe.
All right. Well, thank you so much to both of you. It's been just an excellent, excellent session. And as I said earlier, just both of you are just such a wealth of knowledge. And I'm sure our members will find this extremely helpful. And again, we're very happy to bring it to them as it was one of the most requested topics. So we hope that they'll find it informative. And until our next edition, I'll sign off for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it being invited to do this.
Have a good evening.